Inspired by the radio code for In Service, Team 10-8 is dedicated to those who serve and sacrifice to keep us healthy, safe, and secure. And now, signing in, here's your host, Christian Lane.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Team 10-8 podcast brought to you by Sean Pinto, Mortgage Broker. Our guest this episode is a former senior operations officer with the Royal Canadian Mounted Police and a senior partner and critical risk consultant with an extensive background in resolving critical risk for various entities. During his tenure, he played a crucial role in leading international investigations and intelligence operations worldwide, notably serving as the team leader of Canada's International Negotiators Team and specializing in negotiations related to terrorist and transnational organized crime kidnappings. He's a graduate of the FBI and Scotland Yard's hostage negotiation programs, a 2016 recipient of the International Police Award from the Canadian Association of Chiefs of Police, and currently serves as a director of the Steering Committee for Project CSHAT, an NGO focused on building leadership capacity to address global conflict and security issues facing Western democracies. He brings an absolute wealth of experience in managing crises, security operations, and complex investigations across diverse regions, and joins us today to discuss the importance of carefully navigating the threats, risks, and challenges of our contemporary world. He is Calvin Cresty. How the heck are you, Cal?
Thanks very much. I should have had you, do some of my resumes post my RCMP career. Thanks very much.
Yeah, man, you betcha. You betcha. So listen, I'm glad we finally got to do this. We tried to connect a couple of times previously and for a variety of reasons, it didn't line up, but I'm really glad we're doing this now. You know, the first question I kind of asked myself, well, shit, where do we start? Well, let's do this. I've got a series of headlines that have kind of popped off just over the last 6 months to kind of set the stage for us, right? Okay. So we've got, obviously, we've got money laundering and real estate to significant degrees in Ontario that's been recently reported. We've got the ever-present foreign actor and interference file going on with an inquiry in Ottawa that, depending on who you talk to, is or is not actually going to get at the root cause of the issues there. We've got a former chief of defense staff, General Rick Hillier, basically calling out the government of Canada and Canada itself as facing complete irrelevance, not just amongst our adversaries, but our allies. We have missile and drone attacks in Yemen. We have war in Ukraine and in Palestine. Where do you want to start, Cal?
Well, I'm not sure where to start, but I'll just say that one thing I'll just add as part of the starting point, perhaps, and just see where it goes organically, is we've evolved from Project CSHAT, that NGO that I'm on the steering committee, and now we've evolved to a more contemporary NATO-affiliated NGO called the Council on Countering Hybrid Warfare, which is specifically a group looking at countering many of these issues in primarily in the public space, you know, in terms of the private sector space versus, you know, other entities that are hyper-focused in the public sector domain. So I think maybe just to start with is just to share, you know, maybe how I got so interested in this. I think was probably, I hate to say it, dating back to the early 70s, and twofold was my dad got exposed to some national security issues when I was growing up in Winnipeg. And I recall the Secret Service or the Security Service from the RCMP knocking on our door before a trip he made and after a trip he made. And his trip was in 1971 to the former Soviet Union, where he was going with a group of Canadian academics to look at the Russian educational system in terms of a comparative analysis. In terms of that, I think I got a very early entry into the world of national security, and it was, you know, touched on my family. And his experience was he went over there, studied in the Soviet Union, came back with lots of stories relative to foreign espionage activities that he was exposed to, foreign intelligence operatives that he got exposed to. And I remember hearing these stories in terms of my childhood. Fast forward to probably several years ago, getting more involved in it in the private sector, you know, having been in the RCMP for over three decades, my exposure continued in there. And I came across a guy that I heard about, and his name was Yuri Bezerov, and he was a former KGB operative operating in the 60s and 70s. And he was interviewed for about, I think, an hour and 20 minutes, and you can find his video on YouTube, and it was really insightful. And right around the time I found that was the same time Huawei was happening throughout Canada. Our company was asked to possibly assist in terms of some of the resolution issues with Canadians being detained. We had some preliminary conversations with some clients on there and some preliminary involvement. And then I began quickly watching, or not quickly, but closely watching the way the world was evolving. And in my observations, I think I began, I guess, getting more concerned when I started paying attention to it. And I was already concerned based on my career in the RCMP and federal policing, where we were, you know, addressing a lot of these foreign threat actors from China, from Iran, and others. And then when I started in the private sector watching what was going on with Huawei, the cyber world, and others, and watching how the Canadian government was responding to it and positioning themselves in terms of responding to it, I would say I probably went from being moderately concerned to extremely concerned, to which then we created this NGO called Council on Countering Hybrid Warfare, where I spend, you know, probably 25% of my week, you know, working with the global community, establishing a relationship with some NATO entities, and looking at how this impacts, you know, not only, you know, residents of the Lower Mainland, but how it impacts residents of Canada, how it, you know, impacts residents of Western democracies. So that's probably a starting point for the conversation, in addition to our company that's heavily involved from one day to the next day having to deal with these issues in the private sector and that. So I guess I would just say that at this particular time, most of my life is spent, you know, 24/7 almost interacting with victims and clients and organizations that are subject to this, which has led me to be extremely concerned, and thus we're having this conversation.
Right. And in my opinion, your background is an excellent one to dive into these issues. So a couple of things you mentioned, though. One is your work on, at least initially, on the two Michaels issue. Can you elaborate a little bit for me on what your role was there and the work you were engaged in?
Yeah, I don't want to overstate our role. We were asked to assess our capabilities in terms of assisting and supporting some of the family members in terms of the repatriation potentially of those two. We did not get involved other than the assessment of options, et cetera, et cetera, further than that. But it did trigger us to position our company to take a close look at this, just in case we did get that next phone call saying, okay, we're interested in going this way versus the other way.
Right.
And that's really when I started, you know, extremely interested in this sector and recognized that these issues that we're talking about, as they're framed, aren't so much kind of national security entities, but I think illuminated a couple things. Number one, it's not as if we have these incidents happening like an accident or whatever, but there it appears to be a chronic condition of Canadian society and other societies in Western democracies. So it's chronic, it's ongoing. It's not something that's, oh, hey, we've got a little problem here, a little problem there. It's not a case of a bad apple. It's more systemic issues. And I also think, you know, you always hear, hey, there's cyber issues, there's espionage issues, there's Cameron Ortiz issues, there's issues of foreign state facilitation of execution of Canadian citizens. There's issues of the Iranian state and the relationship with, you know, the Hell's Angels. Everybody seems to be fragmenting the issues, but I think what they're missing is the forest for the trees, that they're all interconnected issues and probably symptomatic of a larger systemic chronic disease plaguing, you know, Western democracies, including Canada, and I would suggest perhaps Canada one of the most.
Now, you talk about this in your report. In November 2023, you and David Luna penned a report that you kind of dropped in the public fora that calls for a variety of things to change within Canada, but also elsewhere, to address what you call a convergence of threats, right? I've got your report up here. One of the lines in the key recommendations, and you're talking in this component, you're talking about organized crime threat actors from the Chinese triads to Mexican cartels to Iranian money launderers and so on. But organized crime across the board, no longer is profit the sole motivator for these criminals. But these threat convergence activities are now being weaponized against rule of law institutions and democratic states for generating more political power, building illicit empires, and financing greater insecurity globally. Is that what you call hybrid warfare, Cal?
Yeah, that is. It's a you know, when you're looking at it close up, it's like, you know, for a policeman, it's a group of criminals. For CSIS, it's a spy or a traitor. For, you know, Department of National Defense, it's an incursion in the Arctic. But I think what's failed in terms of the articulation and the portrayal of this is the interconnectivity and the strategic coordination vis-a-vis, you know, foreign threat actors that actually call these activities and have centers and have policy papers relative to them being a form of warfare. So where Canadians, you know, theoretically look at war and Canadian security apparatus as, you know, ships, planes, submarines, etc., that isn't how our adversaries look at it. They look at it as, you know, the weaponization of anything, ranging from the weaponization of fentanyl, the weaponization of illicit finance, the weaponization of cyber, and the coordination of all these activities plus more in terms of attacking the Western state. And the key consideration is, how do we accomplish our political objectives as we would do, say, theoretically in 1939, that we want to reclaim this area, or in 2000 and whatever it was, 22, where Russia said, hey, we want to claim back parts of Ukraine. How do we do that without firing a bullet? And are there ways to accomplish those same political objectives that Russia is undertaking currently in the absence of firing a bullet and at least engaging in military operations where there's higher risk? And is there ways to accomplish those same ways as we compete for scarce resources, et cetera, et cetera? And I think what we've seen is that those activities are known. Like, say, for example, you go to the Baltic region of the world, you talk to countries there. This isn't a new topic. It's been a very well accepted understanding of the doctrine of the adversaries. And, you know, where we still like to look at, say, the threat actors here as, hey, these guys are transnational organized crime networks. But why are they doing it? Yeah, some of them, 100%. The majority are doing it for financial reasons, but there's also another reason for it. If you listen to, say, for example, Yuri Bezerov, you know, who's the highest profile Russian KGB defector, like in the early 80s, he highlighted the perception of the West wasn't that the KGB was actually focused on espionage. He highlighted that, I think it was like 85% or 80% of the KGB activities are focused at disrupting Western democracies to create vulnerabilities for their other activities and the exploitation of Western democracies in terms of, you know, traditional warfare type thinking. And I think that's what we have here. So when we see, whether it was seeing the Chinese triads coincidentally having engagement with Chinese government officials during visits, post-visits, or, you know, hearing about them, seeing, you know, pictures of them in different settings, or whether it be the Iranian crime networks, you know, they're fairly popular in Vancouver and in Toronto, and thinking, hey, they're cocaine traffickers only, and there's nothing more to them. But, you know, seeing and hearing that there's indicators, and, you know, now recently confirmed publicly, that, you know, there's these organized crime entities connected to foreign states. Like, it appears that this historical activity of transnational organized crime networks and other actors, you know, whether it be cyber or whatever else, seem to be connected and sometimes facilitated and sometimes directed by foreign state and that. And I think Vancouver, as you alluded to in that paper that David Luna and I were tasked to write on behalf of several Fortune 500 companies that were having trouble operating in Canada because of the illicit activity. That's basically what we were saying, that there were these convergence areas in Canada that were having a major impact on, you know, Canadian, not only from a, which we've always heard, you know, in your profession and my former profession, were public safety threats, but they were beyond that. And they weren't as described in the Cullen Commission money laundering inquiry as financial integrity concerns either. That, to me, quite frankly, it's sugarcoating the issue. And they weren't just in terms of social harm issues, as we hear, you know, lots of politicians talk about the drug issues and everything else. Mm-hmm. They're really, like, no doubt about it, we're one of the few countries that doesn't acknowledge it for whatever political reasons it is. These issues are really national security issues and, you know, require a national security type of response, because what really is what's at threat is not, you know, people being drug addicts, not people, you know, losing some data on their servers, you know, in terms of corporations. But what we're really talking about is the fundamental freedoms of democracy, freedom of speech, and our other kind of freedoms that we seem to be taking for granted. And that's, to me, that's the biggest risk in terms of what we have, you know, not to belittle or minimize the significant concerns of, say, 10,000 kids and mentally vulnerable entities being harmed by fentanyl, etc. But all these activities accumulated, and I think this is, you know, what Scotty McGregor did a good job in his book, are just part of the broader mosaic effect in terms of the national security threats.
Let's, I'm glad you mentioned Scott, because I had him on the show a while back, and he like you, has a wealth of experience in this arena, and shared a lot of fascinating information. One of the things I said, I asked him was sort of, you know, well, look, if you accept that, you know, China's engaged in, and you make a good point, Cal, because it's not just China. Right. There's a lot of focus on China, and particularly in British Columbia, given our sort of gateway relationship with Asia and China in particular. But it's not just China. Right. There's other countries out there who are actively seeking to undermine Canadian institutions and Canadian freedom of democracy and all those sorts of things for their own gain. But I asked Scott, to what end? And he said global domination by 2049. Bottom line.
I think so. I sadly, you know, when somebody says that as a Canadian, everybody's kind of going, what? 8 months ago, I was over in Belgium, and in the room were a lot of global think tanks, very reputable individuals, including participants from NATO and other global, you know, research groups in the sphere of national security. And the rest of the world sees it fairly clearly. But for Canadians, this isn't the sport they do well at in terms of national security or defense or intelligence. It's we can say whatever we want. But
why do you think that? Why do you think that is, Cal? Because you're right. There's a number of signals, and I sort of mentioned this at the top too, right? Like when I mentioned General Hillier sort of saying Canada's increasingly becoming irrelevant. And that's not just from our adversaries' standpoint, but from allies as well. And we're increasingly cut out of bilateral or multilateral initiatives and intelligence apparatuses and all these sorts of things. What is it about Canada? Because it seems to me historically that hasn't always been the case. I mean, you look at the example you use of your father going over to Soviet Russia to study. Shows he comes back home and there's an intense interest in his experience and what he saw and learned and who he interacted with and all those sorts of things. The kind of thing you'd expect to hear from a national security organization once you've returned from an adversarial nation. So that I don't think it was always the case that we were sort of turning blind eyes to this sort of activity, but something's happened clearly between then and now. What do you think that is, Cal?
Well, I think there's a couple of considerations, you know, in terms of how we got here. One is geography and, you know, geographically fairly secure in terms of ice to the north historically, not a lot of access to that particular area. And then we had the best and the toughest big brother in the neighborhood in terms of protecting us.
Sure.
And I think that those two things have allowed us to not maybe be exposed to the degree that other nations have in terms of understanding what the real world looked like, because we had a little bit of a buffer. The second part that I would, and that's tied into, you know, our geography and our experiences as well. The next one, you know, I would say is our systems within Canada. Number one, the structure of policing, the structure of military, the mandates of intelligence, of these structures with their systems of procedures, policy, and reporting and everything else. Probably a lot of this stuff, including our legal framework, had some major rehauls in the 80s, i.e. legally the Charter.
The Charter.
When CSIS, you know, in terms of roughly the same time in terms of the national security.
Yeah.
And the world at that time was an extremely different place. And, you know, I reflect like in the 80s, what it was like compared to what it was like now, you wouldn't find the headlines like that. So they created these structures and these systems of interconnectivity as a security apparatus for Canada, including the legal framework of the Charter. It was basically designed for a country that was a bit of an island. And through globalization, technology, more competitive world, you know, economically, financially, increased scarce resources, oil, precious metals, et cetera, things have escalated and moved extremely, extremely quickly and accelerated, you know, through globalization, that the world's a lot more polarized, a lot more dangerous, and a lot smaller. So those threats that were far away are at our doorstep and next door to us and within our community now. There's no longer foreign entities. There's, you know, the boundaries. I remember in policing always hearing from Ottawa all the time when we were working with the Americans and the Aussies, hey, Kellen, you got to worry about sovereignty. Hey, Kellen, you got to worry about sovereignty. Hey, Kellen, you have to worry about sovereignty. Those borders are an imaginary line only to bureaucrats and to some very naive Canadians. Mm-hmm. Threat actors don't see them. They're invisible. The borders are porous. The borders don't mean that much if you don't have major defenses and impediments there to maintain that. And I think as a result of that, Canadians haven't got good insight in terms of, you know, how the world's changed and all the threats. I mean, you look at, you know, the mandate of CSIS where, hey, protect the Canadian government. If you look at an organization like the FBI that has a similar mandate, protect the citizens, there's a unique distinction there between protecting the government and protecting citizens. And yes, in fairness, CSIS investigates national security threats. But if you listen to the narrative now, we can't say this, we can't say that, we can't say this, we can't say that. You don't see the FBI saying that same narrative. Like, they're out there, out front, in your face, you know, educating the public. And everybody else is going, well, it's classified, it's classified, it's classified. I don't know why it's all classified when journalists are finding these things out and our partners are all communicating them around the world. I think it goes to, hey, what's the legal framework? What's the mandate of these organizations?
Sure.
Have they modernized to keep contemporary with the current events? I don't think so. Whose fault is it? Well, it's not one government's fault. It's been going on for 30 or 40 years.
It's all governments of all political stripes, right? So yeah. I've got, you were talking about, I pulled up the CSIS mandate here. So here it is. This is available in Canada.ca. It's the CSIS Government of Canada page. So the CSIS Act says, CSIS collects information and intelligence on activities suspected of constituting threats to the security of Canada. Sounds good so far. And advises the government of Canada. That's the point you're talking about, right?
Yeah.
CSIS also supports other government of Canada departments and agencies through security screening and foreign intelligence collection. So there's nothing, what you're saying is contrary to, say, what the US FBI's mandate is. It's like to protect the citizenry of the United States. And that's enshrined in their, I guess, enabling legislation. That's not the case for our intelligence service.
I think if you look at the overall mandates and the interconnectivity and the legal frameworks around all these things in terms of laws, regulations, legal frameworks, mandates, you'll see that they're not designed to deal with the dynamic, fluid, complex threats that we have been encountering for the last 10, 20, 30 years. If you look at, say, for example, British intelligence report that came out last year. I can't remember if it was MI5 or how it was framed as a document or MI6. If you look at the first 12 pages of their report out of a 40-page report or whatever it was all about legislative changes to deal with contemporary threats and threat activities. If you look at, say, for example, like, say, the money laundering inquiry here, no, we're just going to talk about a few regulations here and there, and we're not going to look at overall legislative overhaul, not our mandate. I'm sorry. The reality is, you know, if you're not going to go there, maybe you shouldn't have gone there in the first place. Because if you're not going to get into the legislative changes, which coincidentally, in my humble opinion, may be because parties may lose votes because it's going to be unpopular, you know, giving police, giving intelligence apparatuses, more powers, more capabilities. So let's kind of make it look like we're doing something. And in fact, at the end of the day, what did we do? I'm not too sure if, you know, I don't think the, you know, medicinal prescription, say, for example, just using the money laundering thing, to me, it was kind of like giving an aspirin and you got leukemia. Like, I don't think it's going to deal with the deep-rooted systemic issues drivers from, you know, geopolitical entities like China, like the cartels, like Iran, like Russia. You aren't going to fix those issues through regulatory changes and creating a small financial unit to take a look at it. So, like, the changes really have to be a lot broader.
In the world of those who serve, this podcast is brought to you by Sean Pinto Mortgage Broker, a former law enforcement officer who's committed to supporting our heroes in uniform. Your home is more than a dwelling. It's a sanctuary. Our sponsor, Sean Pinto, specializes in tailored mortgage solutions crafted for those who've committed themselves to protecting and serving our communities. Whether you're envisioning a new home, exploring refinancing options, or seeking expert mortgage advice, you can trust in Sean Pinto Mortgage Broker. With a deep understanding of your circumstances, Sean is dedicated to providing the support you need. Reach out to Sean today at seanpinto@invis.ca or give him a call at 778-228-0112. And don't forget to mention the Team 10A podcast for a special discount on your mortgage services. Because in matters of home financing, you deserve a partner who understands the importance of your service. Sean Pinto Mortgage Broker, your ally in securing a home as strong as your dedication. Cal, I want to circle back to what you call the weaponization of fentanyl for a moment, because I was going through some stats a little while ago and something struck me. So all told, Canada's World War II dead, right? And this is, we didn't see conflict on our shores. Apart from, an errant shell from a Japanese submarine. And I think we actually captured a German submarine too in the St. Lawrence River. But apart from that, our cities weren't being bombed. So these are just our war dead. These are predominantly men, but probably some women as well, that were engaged in active combat. So Canada's total war dead, 42,042, right? That's a lot of people.
Yeah.
If you take a look at the latest reporting from Health Canada specific to toxic drug deaths, and you kind of, yeah, I'm no mathematician, but if you kind of forecast forward using the existing kind of markers, we've already surpassed that number in terms of toxic drug deaths. And that's bad enough. But what really, really stood out for me is overwhelmingly the Canadians that have died have been fighting age males. Now, hearing those stats, what does that say to you when you consider your statement around the weaponization of fentanyl?
A lot. I mean, first response coming from the sketchy part of Winnipeg is a emotional response, but I'll refrain from the emotional response.
Emotion is allowed here, Cal. We're all human.
First of all, I find it disgusting. And I find it disgusting, be quite frank, not just from the triad's perspectives. I find it disgusting, you know, from our institutions that aren't making this a top public issue.
Right.
Because if you removed the fortunate development of Narcan and the quick response of some sectors of society to facilitate medication of Narcan to mitigate the deaths, you know, with first responders in paramedics and police and fire in terms of responding to this, it'd be really interesting to do a study and go, hey, those numbers of, you know, say 50,000 that you mentioned, you know, would those numbers be 500,000?
Right.
Because that's what they're putting out on the street. So if those numbers are 500,000 without Narcan, and being familiar with personally family members, including first responders families that are like great families that have lost kids in here, on watching and listening to politicians, former law enforcement, I think it's a reflection in terms of our, you know, moral, ethical fiber. I'm probably even culturally, our cultural norm or value placed on courage, as everybody's scared to say stuff because, you know, politically, here's your mandate, here's your priorities. And at the end of the day, how can not countering those networks and their weaponization of fentanyl not be a national priority? And, you know, I watched it all the time and, you know, going, hey, you know, have this organization or this organization. But I mean, I will say, you know, when I was in, you know, I was told, hey, my priority was fentanyl, and we dealt with it. But it's not just a policing problem. If you go to the U.S. and when I was in policing, our partnerships were probably, I had closer partnerships with the FBI, with the DEA, with Homeland Security, than I did, you know, and I had some with CBSA, I had some with VPD. I wasn't seeing huge interconnectivity of provincial and federal institutions like I was in the U.S. I go to the U.S., like, we would get U.S. military folks showing up in the office saying, how can we help? What can we do? Here's the information. We have it. I didn't have that in Canada. I didn't see military guys having conversations about fentanyl.
Right.
I didn't see intelligence officers coming to my office saying, oh, hey, we're working on the Chinese and the fentanyl. Listen, the threats of illicit finance, espionage, foreign interference, electoral interference, all those things are interconnected. I mean, Sam Cooper made the public document and goes, hey, they're all interconnected. You know, Scott McGregor's come and saying, every journalist is doing it every day. So to kind of say, well, we only focus on this, not that, Well, it's kind of a reflection then that our institutions don't understand the interconnectivity of it. And it sounds like a rather bureaucratic rather than an operational response to these threats. So that's kind of my response to how I feel about it and what I think about it. I think it's extremely concerning. I mean, the Americans are having serious conversations about it. They met with the Chinese recently, but the mere fact that, hey, the Chinese respond, and I say Chinese is in the foreign state, will respond to fentanyl and work with them on fentanyl if they resolve and address some of the issues on Taiwan and trade and economics. I think that's a statement in itself in terms of, is there a weaponization of fentanyl or not?
Good point. Let's be real, right? Like, These numbers are very, very high. They're predominantly male, fighting-aged male Canadians that are succumbing to toxic drugs. I'm not advocating that people are going to find ways to escape. So whether it's alcohol, drugs, or intense fitness, or whatever it is, people are always looking for ways to mentally escape. And so that's ultimately, in my mind anyway, what drug use is all about. So the cultural kind of piece of this, it reminded me of, going back to the two Michaels issue, right? So you had Michael Spavor and Michael Kovrig that were imprisoned shortly following the detention of Huawei CFO, I think she was, Meng Wanzhou, right?
Yeah.
But there was another Canadian too. Can you remember his name?
The other Michael?
Nope. There's Michael Spavor and Michael Kovrig. Those are the two Canadians. The two Michaels. But there was another Canadian that was also detained at the same time. And I'll tell you right now, I didn't remember his name. I had to look it up. Robert Lloyd Schellenberg. Robert Lloyd Schellenberg was detained for drug smuggling at the same time that Michael Kovrig and Michael Spavor were detained ostensibly for espionage, right?
Yeah.
Not a single public movement to free Schellenberg. In fact, he was ultimately executed for his crimes by the Chinese state. But we're not talking about him because he's a drug dealer. What do we care, right? It's drugs. And that's that same kind of cultural thing I think you're talking about with respect to the toxic drug deaths in Canada. We're like, they're drug users. Who cares? But they're Canadians. And they're Canadians that have been targeted by a drug that is fatal if taken in certain doses. And is like you say, fortunately, you know, we've got naloxone on the shelves and with first responders to help prevent or bring people back from overdose. But as drugs continue to get stepped on with other types of substances like benzodiazepines and elsewhere, naloxone ceases to become effective. So Canadians need to wake up. They need to wake up to that issue. And I'm hearing this from you. I'm hearing this from obviously Sam Cooper's reporting. I'm hearing it from Scott McGregor and other folks who are just laser focused on this stuff. Canada needs to wake up. Canadians need to wake up. What is it ultimately going to take, Cal?
I think it's going to be one of two things. One, it's going to be a major catastrophe of some sort happening that usually shifts policy thinkers and Canadians and other nations. That's kind of been the history. But I think what I'm slowly seeing is our partners are saying, you know, as my father would say, hey, if you're sitting on the fence, you're going to get slivers in your ass. And I think those conversations have been going on for a long time with Canadians for the last 4 or 5 years. And I would say with a extremely high degree of confidence that those conversations have been taking place. And you're seeing Canadians being displaced on the outside, you know, whether it be the AUKUS or whether it be, you know, some, you know, foreign international collaboration relative to the issues with India. I mean, you're seeing it in a lot of different domains. Now, you get the defense contractors that say it's because we're not spending enough money on defense, thus we're not in the game.
Right.
Would just say that my insights would suggest is a factor, but to another factor is Canada is considered somewhat compromised as a foreign ally in terms of within our political systems, within our educational systems, within our security systems, even we're seeing, which is like crazy. And I'm not saying other entities don't have their own, you know, espionage cases and spies. But when you look at most of the big national security exposés, you know, they're coming out of the U.S. The U.S. goes, hey, we're, you know, Cameron Ortiz. You know, there's been another Canadian one there going, hey, blah, blah, blah. I wonder where that came from. You know, I know, you know, Canadian police are looking at another one. But then you look at a lot of these and you wonder how much is coming from the U.S. and our partners versus how much is coming from within Canada. So I think our foreign entities, you know, they see the value of having a partnership and relationship with us. But I think, you know, just like our paper, you know, corporate entities are even coming forward to companies like ours asking us for assistance because they're having a tough time operating in Canada. We're having more and more of these conversations with the private sector that I think are losing confidence, not in terms of the people within our security apparatus in Canada. It's not the people. I think it's more complex than the people. I think it's more complex than just the funding, but the whole, you know, systematic framework, you know, in terms of mandates, in terms of legal framework, in terms of even cultural norms, you know, in terms of Canada's indifference, naive, you know, naive, maybe blended with even a little bit of arrogance these days. I think, you know, countries are kind of starting to put the pressure on Canada to say, hey, you know, you're going to have to get off the fence and pick a side. You're not going to be able to watch the show. And I'm hoping that will be what changes us versus, you know, a major catastrophe, you know, but who knows where it's going to go. But I just say it's not looking really, really positive. And I just came back from Toronto meeting some very senior business leaders there relative to my business. And there's a lot of nervous Canadian business leaders that are really concerned about, you know, the future of Canada, including in the business world, but also, you know, for the next generation.
What are they nervous about? Is it because, you know, anyone hearing that is going to go, well, I mean, business is all they're concerned about is making money, right? But in your meetings with some of these senior leaders, as you state, what are they concerned about? Why is it, you know, difficult for them to operate here? What are the top one or two things that really concern them to such a degree that they're even calling you?
Well, some of them come from the diaspora communities, so they're under different threats from physical, personal, cyber threats. Their companies, you know, espionage threats, and they're seeing that, you know, even though there's many good-hearted professions, you know, in law enforcement, intelligence, and that, they don't have the tools to be able to deal with it. Mm-hmm. You know, they think it's a capacity issue, but, you know, as I said to a politician in BC one day, when they said, hey, Kelvin, if I give you 150 more cops on your transnational organized crime unit, would that help? And my response was, not that much, because it's going to be 150 more cops with their hands tied, you know, frustrated and going, we can't do this, we can't do that. You know, the mm-hmm. expectations of police managers are, hey, we want you to investigate and prosecute and focus on that. And you can do that as much as you want, but if you have that as a strategic objective, all that shows me is you have a lack of experience in terms of policing international global crime networks. And I've heard that from lots of people. So I think these business, sorry, to go back, went down a rabbit hole. These business leaders just don't see, you know, what's on the horizon for the next generation. And they're seeing foreign companies, you know, the government saying, hey, we're not going to allow any more mining companies, you know, from China in this space. And they came out with a policy, but they never implemented it or executed. So China's still coming in looking at our precious metals. Then, you know, if they try to do something, then they just slip through another loophole and find proxies, and we'll find a couple farmers from Manitoba and go through a venture capitalist firm and give them money, you know, to go, hey, can you buy this for us? And you got a couple, you know, lackey farmers from
nominees. You know, you're talking about nominees. Yeah.
Yeah. Coming over and taking over the mining firm for them. But where's the money? Who are the controllers? Who's the shareholders?
Right.
And all this stuff. So they're watching this, and I think some of the public companies, and this was a conversation I had one night in Toronto last week. When you're a public company, you don't care because you're just trying to make money for, hey, I'm with this company for 4 years, 3 years, 2 years, 5 years. And yes, on LinkedIn, everybody goes, hey, I'm loyal to the company and this, but I'm not sure if they really are loyal to the company versus, hey, they're just marking time. But you get into some of the conversations with some of the family businesses that have been in Canada for one generation, two generation, three generation, four generation, and they've, had to go through the dirty 30s and the war times and came as immigrants. They're super proud of what their families have accomplished. They're very worried about everything that they've worked so hard generation wise and the respect they have for their forefathers. And, perhaps some of them were fighting in the war. And now they're kind of going, hey, we're losing it all. We're going to lose it all. All the stuff that our family, spent, two, three, four generations about. Those people actually do care is what I learned. And there is a difference between the public companies and the private family companies. And I think it was pointed out to me, from a high net worth individual / client of ours, that those people are really concerned and they really care. So there is that, what you said, hey, there's some people that are in just for the money, but there are some very caring, very moral, ethical, loyal, patriotic Canadian business leaders that are really worried about it, I think, sadly.
I'm heartened to hear that. And, you mentioned your conversation with a politician a long time ago, and that got me thinking, well, here we are in the province of BC anyway. I'm not sure if elsewhere in the country, but we're going to be into provincial elections in the fall of this year. We'll have a federal election in the fall of next year, if not perhaps earlier, if the Conservative Party, I'm sure, has it their way. And then we've got municipal elections in the fall of 2026. So what's your advice, Cal, to aspiring politicians or those who are going to continue to serve in office? What are you going to tell them if you're in a room full of these folks as they're kind of getting ready to go to the polls and pound and knock on doors and all that sort of stuff? What are you going to tell these folks, these future leaders of our governments at various levels?
Well, funny, we're actually running a little bit of an experiment with a community in Canada, which will remain anonymous just for discretion purposes. But, the one thing that I learned when I was doing my last degree at Osgoode Law and I was doing my master's of law, the last course that I had in the world of negotiations and peacemaking was this guy came in and said, I'm going to teach you a course on advanced negotiations. So he starts he was a guy out of San Francisco, and he said, everybody here before they got into the program was already trained, practiced, seasoned, professional negotiator. Then we did, two, 3 years of academic setting in terms of training and education in this field, at one of the top law schools in Canada. And he said, the last course I'm going to teach you is all about going from a professional level to being a master of negotiations. And that whole course was about self-awareness, self-reflection. And I think, what Canadian leaders need to do is take a good look and look in the mirror and look at the communities that you're representing. Do you actually know which businesses are in that community? Do you know which foreign entities are running the businesses in there? Do you know what's happening there within the diaspora community? Do you know anything about any of this stuff, or are you looking at the superficial things in terms of just moving ahead? And when you look at the deep-rooted interconnectivity of corporate relationships with criminal relationships, with illicit finance relationships, with political entities, if you really take the time to really reflect on your community and know your community, which I don't think most of them take that much time on it, I think they'll be rather awakened and alive to the concerns and the risk. And, as they first said many, many years ago, first they came, for this person, then they came, for this, and then they came for the Jews, and then they came for the Japanese, and then they came for me. And I think politicians need to kind of wake up, realize, and accept the fact that the crosshairs are now also on them. And if they aren't proactive in dealing with this, if they're not doing their own due diligence, who's getting in their parties, and looking at who's getting in their parties and doing some due diligence. And I just saw something last night kind of going, okay, somebody just got nominated for blah, blah, blah party. And I'm looking at them and I go, it'd take me probably 15 minutes, 10 minutes of some Google searches to go, I don't know if I would have that person in a political party because of these relationships.
Right.
But, you know, that's probably what I would say is take the time, you know, for some self-reflection, because if they don't invest in the front end in terms of due diligence and making sure they have integrity within their organizations, I think it's going to bite them back, you know, post the elections, and then it's going to hurt us all. I mean, the threat actors we're talking about, China, Russia, Iran, you know, you hear it all the time. Hey, you know, especially, you know, from our world, oh, it's about the money. It's not just about the money, guys. It's about the politics too. And it's about the geopolitics in it. And these threat actors are not looking at just about the money. They're looking at how to disrupt and create chaos in our society. And when you look at the issues of, you know, whether it be race or fentanyl or, well, foreign interference or health or whatever it is, they seem to be doing a very good job putting us in a chaotic state. And I guess one of the things that I would be saying if I was king, you know, in that room would be, you know, looking at the security apparatuses in Canada, telling them to work closer together and to be focused not so much just on the Canadian government's interests, but what are the Canadian citizens' interests. And if people are a little concerned, scared or whatever else, again, reflect to 1939 and what Canadian, you know, our forefathers did and the sacrifices they made for this country, the courage they showed, and go, hey, everybody, how about showing a little, you know, a fraction of that courage in terms of your service to Canada?
Great advice, Cal. I was chatting with a guy who used to work in our consulate in China at one point in his career, and he shared this conversation he had with a CIA guy with me. And the CIA guy says to him, you know, I liked it better when we were fighting the Russians, because if they wanted your beach, they'd show up with great big trucks and load it all up and drive away. The Chinese take it pebble by pebble.
Yeah.
And yeah, that sums up kind of where we're at.
Yeah. And I'll give you a Calvinism for this. They're chess players, we're checker players, but sometimes I think we're playing 52 pickup most of the time right now.
Hey, listen, Cal, if folks want to connect with you, talk to you about your business, learn a little bit more about what you're up to next, where can they go about doing that?
LinkedIn is one, and then we have a website, the Critical Risk Team, but LinkedIn's probably easiest. That's probably the easiest one, just to send me a quick fire there. I don't want to overcomplicate the communication channels.
There you go. And as we always do, we'll have all the information linked in the show notes for listeners. If they want to connect with you, they can just click on the show notes and fire away. Cal, I want to thank you very much for taking the time with us. Covered a lot of topics today, all of which are, I think, critical to Canada and Canadians. And so appreciate that. But more importantly, sir, I want to thank you for your service.
And I want to thank you for your service, and particularly this podcast, because I think what a lot of Canadians don't realize that the most important space, you know, we may think, you know, historically it was policing or this or military or whatever else, but the information space is probably the most important space. And the service that you provide is huge, I think, in terms of national security and mitigating the threat. So I appreciate what you do as well.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening. If you're enjoying the show, please take a moment to give us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts and write a review. It's easy to do and a huge help in improving our exposure on podcast platforms so we can deliver these important stories to even more listeners. And if you have a story idea or you know someone you'd like to hear profiled on the show, please find a quiet room like a closet, record a voice memo on your phone and email it to stories@team108.com. Until next time, stay safe, everyone.